Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 18th. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Ingrid Christiansen, continuing her series on reading and writing our stories. Today's session is number 6 and is titled Two Chapters in Our Women's Life by Eunice Scarf. Let's listen in.
My name is Ingrid Christiansen, and the title of this session is something about two stories in one person's life, one woman's life. And the stories that I am going to read to you are the stories of a woman called Eunice Stoa Scarf. She is the daughter of a Lutheran pastor. Her father... Pastor Stoa was a pastor in Seattle for many years. Some of you may have known him. And she is one of the few Lutheran story writers that I know who actually uses her Lutheranness in her stories and refers to hymns that we all know and love. And she, Deanne, you've done a lot of work in the area of trying to find Lutheran story writers.
Just about it, of anyone who's alive.
Yeah, she's very rare in that way. She's not published a lot, but she's published some. She has written a wonderful novel, which is about the formation of the ALC back in 1965, or whenever that was. And I have read parts of that other years up at Holden, and it's a wonderful, wonderful novel. But today I'm going to read two of Eunice's stories that come from and I think reflect some things about her life experience, which we've been talking about, and if you've been to other things I've done on story in the last week, it talks about the kind of role that each of us as a creative person has in telling our story in order to impose some order on our life and to come to understand our lives better. Story has the power. When we tell our stories, and we can tell our stories in a wide variety of ways, and they don't have to be always literally our stories, they can expiate our sins, they can give us a measure of control over our lives, they can recast the stories of our lives in a way that make us more comfortable with them. They can, if we tell our stories to people who we believe love us, they can make us feel as though we've been heard and understood in very important ways. And I think they can free us from some anxiety, some guilt, some bad feelings. When you tell something you've done that you feel anxious about to somebody who loves you, it's because you trust that they will put the most charitable construction on it. They will understand your motivation. They'll care enough about you that they'll believe you to be a good actor in that story. And if you've done things you feel bad about, they'll understand why. When I feel something anxious about something I've done at work, I always want to go home and tell my husband, because he loves me, and he will help. He will look at it and say, "Well, of course you said that, or of course you did that, because," and he understands me. So that's one of the powerful things that a story can do in a healing way for us all in our lives. I think that you can also get art out of that. I think the stories, there are two stories, two chapters maybe, or two stories I'll read today, that are beautifully constructed stories, but I know Eunice, the author, and I know that the stories also help her dealing with some of the facts of her life. And they help her understand her life. Another thing that stories do, which these two stories do, is when you love someone, you know their stories, and they add depth to your understanding of the person. So that if you know some of the dominant themes of the beloved people in your lives, when they tell you a new story, it isn't a totally new story. It's layered. It refers, it echoes, it harkens back to, and it adds depth to. So when we are good listeners to one another, we do that for each other. We hear the themes of our lives emerge. And it is a great relief to us sometimes to have good listeners in our lives that care about us and understand our life stories. Tomorrow in a session, we're actually going to do some story writing about our lives, little tiny bits of it. But today we're going to look at somebody else's story writing. One of the nice things about these two stories is that they are about hope. And we talked some this morning in Bible study about hope. And I think that these stories explore the role of hope in our lives in a beautiful way. And I think it was yesterday in Bible study, somebody said, I think Randy said, the Americans have lost their story. Americans don't know their story. And so I thought, well, this is bad not to know your story. And so it's really another reason why we should keep telling our stories to each other. A little tiny bit of background about this. Eunice's husband was killed seven or eight years ago while we were all at Holden Village. And Eunice and her husband were due the next Saturday at Holden Village to be on teaching staff. And he was running to work one morning with his backpack on his back. He taught at University of Edmonton in Edmonton, Alberta. And early at 8:30 in the morning, his person in a Mercedes-Benz, who was stoned and drunk, jumped off the highway onto the running path next to, in a park, and knocked Chris into the ravine, and he was dead. So, and they had two children, you know, young children. So that piece of background you should probably know, because the stories are about fear and hope and death and safety and danger. The importance of listening and telling your story comes up in the stories. And the other sort of theme that Eunice picks up on nicely, I think, is place. She talks about the importance of place. So those are all kind of themes you might be listening for as you listen to these stories. I think I'll read one, we'll talk about it a little, and then I'll read the other. The characters in the first story are the narrator, who is Eunice Stoescarf, and her daughters, Emily and Sarah, and her niece, Ellen, and her fiancé, Carl. Her fiancé, Carl, came into her life 5 years after her husband was killed. So, with those things said, I will read you the story called The Landing. And we can talk about it some. The Landing by Eunice Stoescarf. When I arrived tonight, I said to you that this summer we were hovering like bees around honeycomb. The honeycomb is home, our 1912 home, bought in 1973, the summer before my eldest daughter was born, 20 years ago this month. We is my companion and fiancé Carl, my daughters Sarah and Emily, my sister's youngest daughter Ellen, and me, Eunice Victoria, of the Stoa home, of the Jordal home, of the Wangan home, whose home is now in Oss, above the fjord, as well as in Edmonton, beside the wide prairie. Home where the heart and the hearth live in harmony. It wasn't always like this, that we hovered around home like bees around honeycomb. Not too long ago, my daughters and I hovered around home like Dutch children, around a hole in a dike, unable, too terrified to move. I left them upstairs on the landing. Five small rooms open out onto this landing, while a wide staircase leads up to this landing. In one room, Carl sits at the computer where he has helped Sarah type and print her resume all day. This resume is up to date, not dated, hot off the press. She has added volunteer work at Grandview Extended Care Center, which she starts tomorrow morning. She has added volunteer work at St. Joseph's Hospital, which she starts tomorrow afternoon. She has added teaching at the gymnastics program, which she did for the last 2 weeks. She may as well add future plans, hopes, and dreams to her resume. To have such a category again is an accomplishment in itself. She has spent today sorting her room, sifting through the last 5 years. None of us has wanted to sort through the last 5 years. She is the first in this house to do so. My last 5 years are boxed in my study. Emily's last 5 years are boxed in her walk-in closet. Look at the flowers Calvin drew me the day he didn't send me flowers during exams, Sarah says. This drawing does not get boxed. This drawing gets hung on the wall. She is busy, active, alive again, with energy and dream. Sarah's bedroom door is open so she can hear the tape Emily and Ellen play in the hall. Emily and Ellen are sewing on the landing. They are sprawled on the floor. Ellen is sewing up a seam on white long johns with red embroidery thread. Emily is sewing a beanbag. She asks me, should she use pearl barley or white navy beans? I announce very emphatically, which fools no one, that the larger the beans, the less chance of swelling from damp or of molding from heat. I rush up and down the stairs as I say these words. I know that Emily knows where the beans are. They are in the jars that she labeled last summer and set in the cupboard above the refrigerator. Large labels, large lettering, large jars. We were ready to sort the kitchen last summer, but not the papers and pictures and clippings and cards and files and letters marking death's entry into our home. We have grown accustomed to not knowing where things are in this house. What we don't find, we forget or borrow or ignore. We all come out of our rooms to this landing, face each other here, meet and greet and pass in speech or in silence. Last night, Emily and Ellen dressed in clothes from the trunks in the eave closets and modeled the clothes on the landing, while Sarah advised on appropriate hairstyles and distributed suitable jewelry. I gave out hats. Carl took photographs. Emily posed in a long dress from the summer of 1972. Ellen appeared in the dress I provided my bridesmaids in 1968, made to match the 1900 wedding dress my grandmother provided me, China silk with hand-stitched and pin-tucked pleats, enlarging the wearer's well-covered bosom. They found the leather sandals I bought in Greenwich Village in 1964. They tried on everything that they found. The landing holds the history of our home. The landing has been busy this week. We haven't all been here together since Christmas. Sarah came first, flying in from Seattle, where we celebrated my mother's 80th birthday. Ellen, Emily, and I drove in at 2 a.m. on a Saturday night, weary from driving through the mountains of Washington State, B.C., and Alberta. And Carl came on Wednesday, all the way from the high skies of Norway. Five of us cross and double-cross this landing, and no one is crying now. No one is limp with exhaustion or sorrow or sadness or anger. Not this week am I lying prone in bleak and dark despair. Was it so bad? Was it worse? In this house, to which 5 years ago Tuesday, the police came knocking, then left when there was no answer. To which the police came again, leading me into my own home, refusing to leave until I called someone to come. Refusing to leave me alone. Had they left me alone, I would have come to this landing, come to the floor of this landing, held onto the spindles of the railings and howled. I would have screamed, holding on fast. I would have screamed outrage and horror into the wood and the walls and the witness of this sturdy old house, this fortress and this castle, this comfort, this home. I would have written the story into the wood and the walls. I would have kicked and pounded the floor with my feet, beaten my heels against the murder, the violence, the violated body of the husband, the father, gone for good from this house. Not gone for good, gone for evil. The evil of a car out of control on Saskatchewan Drive. The evil of a man choosing to drive after taking cocaine and alcohol into his blood. The evil of negligence and stupidity and crime. Gone not for good, but forever. hit by a car climbing up and over the curb, thrown into the ravine, dying instantly, they say, unseen and alone, found only by accident a long hour later. I fled this landing as often as I hid there. At times I imagined we would go with him. I planned from this landing how we would go to him. I sat on this landing and planned while the house whispered. I sat on this landing and planned while the walls watched. The windows darkened. Weeds grew over the windows. The roof slid down to the ground. The chimney poured exhaust and fumes and sparks back into the belly of the house, to here, to its heart, to our landing. We choked on poisoned air. The kitchen pots rusted to the shelves. The plates chipped. The cutlery, my much-loved Sheffield stainless steel set, disappeared piece by piece. Clothes carpeted the sagging floors, dirty, abandoned, discarded. Did I ever go out? Did I move? Did I see all this through the eyes of an ancestor's photo sitting on the mantelpiece? Out of the face of the Viennese clock, through a crack in the door? I don't remember being present, being here, being home. The landing is the listening post of our house. It wasn't always like it was tonight that I left the landing to hear the children hollering down the stairs, "Have a good time, when will you be back?" It wasn't always like this, that two white faces weren't pressed against the window, worried, the older one trying to hug the younger. "How do we know you'll be back? What should we do if you don't? Who should we call?" 10 minutes of kisses, of clinging. "Drive safely, Mummy. Call when you get there. Can you call before you come home? Call if you're going to be late. Promise you'll call. Could we come with you? Do you mind if we stay up until you get home? Do you have to go?" Why did I ever leave? How could I have left them alone? They watched me leave for a hearing 6 months after their father died. They accompanied me to a trial 18 months after their father died. For nearly 4 years, they watched me leave for consultations and interrogations by a merciless insurance company. They watched a detective watch me. They watched me come and go with slower and heavier steps. We all, the three of us, watched time pass. We have come now to this home, to our home, to the heart of our home, to this landing, 5 years after his death. Did we miss any shortcuts? Did it have to take this long? Was there a quicker way to come to this well-lit, cheerful, noisy landing tonight? 2 years ago, you said, "What is he doing, still sitting in the living room, still hovering on the landing?" A year ago, you said, "He's gone. You have let him go. He was waiting for you to give him leave to bless his going." He wasn't there tonight when I left, not there on the landing, not singing in the shower, or standing in the entrance hall, or sitting on the screened-in porch, or coming up the walk. We gave him our leave. Godspeed. Good journey. Go in peace. He wasn't at home when I left tonight. The first definition of death: no longer home. We've come back home. We are at home. There was light in the house when I left tonight. Light and lightness again in the heart of our being, our home. So, do you have some comments about that story? Or how does it make you feel? What does it do?
You definitely get that sense of place that you mentioned. Through a lot of things she does, but one thing is that kind of a repetition she has. Mm-hmm. This place, this home, this landing. Mm-hmm. And you just have a sense of the importance of that place. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she returns to it almost like a mantra or a litany. Mm-hmm. And she's landing there each time, and she lands differently. And you see the different kinds of landings. I mean, you see the landings at first, right after the death, when the police walked her in, and mm-hmm. and then the landings with the children, and the terrible, long... How many of you have been through that? Yeah, a number of you know that. And does it ring true? Does it sound like what that's like?
My first husband was killed in a plane crash when I had two small children. Mm-hmm. And it was the same kind of thing. So my story, that story, which is what stories do. And this was 27 years ago. But powerful when that can happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a request. Is it possible that we can sit all in a circle so that I don't listen with my back to what I just heard?
I don't know. Do people want to move? I know that some people like to sit where they get the most light for the work they're doing, so.
That struck me. My family owned the same home for four generations, and then my folks sold it, and then 10 years later, my sister and her husband bought it back, so it was back in the family for 10 years. And when she talked about the witness of this sturdy old house, I thought about all that house had witnessed mm-hmm. for all of those generations. Some very sad things, mm-hmm. alcoholism and all of that sort of thing, but yet that was home, mm-hmm. and that will always be my home.
Mm-hmm. And Eunice talks in here about the witness of the landing being really the only witness to her thoughts of suicide and right. and killing herself and her children and, right. you know, the deep depression that wet landing had to absorb. At first, the fury and the anger, but then those dark months.
The walls whispered. What was the phrase she used? The walls whispered. Mm-hmm. There was another parable to that.
Well, the house experienced the depression.
Yeah.
I mean, the roof caved down. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of dark imagery in there mm-hmm. too. The color, I don't know, but it seems to me to remember.
There was.
The colors of it also.
Now, do you think it's literally the case that the roof caved in? Right. And so it's so important when you're thinking of, I mean, this story you could say is autobiographical,
right. mm-hmm.
but it's a fictional story. Mm-hmm. And it's important to say that that's fiction.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a little, you know, at a point there, it's sort of blurred what did happen and what didn't happen in her own mind, too. She questions that. Was it that bad? Was it worse? Mm-hmm. You know, so the roof didn't come down, but then she also talks about the clothes were everywhere on the floor. Well, in deep depression, there can be that, mm-hmm. where just mm-hmm. you just cannot do ordinary tasks. Mm-hmm.
And certainly the telling us those things helps us to understand the depression, whether or not it was true.
I think well, she might have seen it that way also. I mean, whether... Yeah, well, that's what I'm wondering when you define fiction. That if it's part of our imagination, that... it's fiction. When I think about fiction, I think that it's because we've turned things differently. Not that the images are... if they're part of our imagination, then that's true, that's real. But if they've been turned differently in the story and placed here instead of where they were here, that might take the nonfiction and turn it into fiction. But if it's part of an imagination, although maybe it isn't until after she's had the experience and then she looks back on it, and then in her imagination, this house falling like that is exactly what happens in that depression. Mm-hmm. So then it's, I don't know. Personally, I don't know if I like the word fiction at all, because I think that all stories are true.
Yes, see, that's important.
And so
you could hand this to your children and say, this is what it was like.
Mm-hmm. This is real.
This is real. This is my story. Mm-hmm. All stories are true. I think that's really important. I mean, she picks and chooses details. Why does she does all that stuff with dates? Her wedding dress was made in 1900. Mm-hmm. The house was built in 1912. Mm-hmm. This is the 5-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. There are lots and lots of dates in there. Why do you think they're what? How does that work for you?
Life goes on. The dates continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the history, the rootedness, the witness of history that's part of who she is, mm-hmm. but life does go on. It's got a future. I think that's wonderful. That seems right to me.
Well, it doesn't focus on reality, too. When everything else is sort of floating around, you have to anchor in something. Maybe that's a reality check. There's mm-hmm. a date there.
Mm-hmm. The last paragraph is, we've come back home. We are at home. There was light in the house when I left tonight. Light and lightness again in the heart of our being, our home. So it does come, there's a hopeful note at the end. It picks up on the light. But this next story ends with the word hope.
There's a full circle too, with the dreams that her daughter has, and she, I mean, she's got mm-hmm. some really nice transitions in there.
Mm-hmm.
That dream there is real important, that she wishes she could put that in the resume, and then it appears in her at the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good.
And at first, when you see the kids kind of fooling around on the landing and sewing and mm-hmm. putting sorting boxes, you think, well, what is the significance of this?
Mm-hmm.
But then you sort of feel like she nails it home that it is significant, mm-hmm. partly when you hear the story of how they were
mm-hmm.
during those hard years, the bad years.
Well, that it's possible to get those clothes out now. That it's possible to look at them being worn, mm-hmm. to raise the memory, mm-hmm. is a miracle
mm-hmm.
that happens in the telling of the story.
Mm-hmm.
That release part at the end, that it's also an act she had to release before she could be released. And I was thinking, I haven't experienced the death of a spouse nor the divorce, but I was thinking of our daughter who is looking for release from a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what she says is the most difficult thing, is releasing the hopes and the dreams,
yeah.
and finding that reality wasn't what she anticipated. Until she can be released, she can't really move on anywhere else.
Yeah. I've heard lots of people say that when you're divorcing, one of the greatest griefs is the loss of the dreams and the assumptions about the future.
Do you think that's why she doesn't give the results of the trial? Because she's let go of it?
Maybe it's not so important anymore. Yeah, she's let go of it. I think that's probably right.
Because obviously it was painful going through it, because she mentioned it was all part of the process, but yeah. She doesn't bother to say what happened.
Yeah.
Or with the insurance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's all stuff that, you know, you go through after a thing like this, but that wasn't what this story was about. The details that she chose to include here. We know some very specific detailed things, but we do not know that. So that isn't what this story was about, in a sense.
I felt like talking about the house being neglected. I lost my oldest son a year ago after a two-year illness with Lou Gehrig's disease.
Oh, how awful.
And I know last year, when I was getting ready to go on this trip, I went down and I found clothes that I never wore last year, and I said to my husband, you know, whatever happened last year? I said, nothing was ever the same. We just kind of, you don't even realize, you think you're handling things well, but as you look back, it wasn't, you know.
Oh dear, I'm sorry. And I'm sure that year is partly lost forever, and partly probably bits and pieces will come back.
And then my grandson, I could relate to a lot of things that she said about the children, because so much of, you know, you don't think as much about yourself, you think about that child that was left without a father, the important person in his life.
And somehow the language that was used in this story, it almost like gained speed during that part of the story. You know, it was so compelling. It was so, you know, these children. We do emotionally grieve through children sometimes, I think.
But also see the life we have. That was the first piece that you said about in the resume. It's amazing that she has the dream that we think should go into it. That's the first eyes you see that it goes through. Which I think is real.
Very.
I think that's very real. That the children lead.
Children grieve deeply, though, and long.
My grandson made a pewter teardrop that he's in his first year of college now. He put that pewter teardrop on a chain and wrapped it around the base on his father's grave. And I thought that was just so endearing that he did that. Because a lot of kids that age don't do things that are tangible.
And show their, express their feelings, yeah.
But he didn't tell us that he did it. We had to discover it and ask him, and then he told us that he had made it. That was heartwarming for me to see that he could do that.
Well, do you want to hear the next chapter? Okay. This chapter is, her fiancé is a Norwegian man. And after 5 years, you know, she got into this new relationship with Carl. And so they were in Norway, going to their home there. They have two homes. I have to tell you that Carl, too, was killed before they were married, but that is not in this story. This story was written in February of 95 and is not yet published. Although it may have just been published, I think. It's called Suite in C Minor. When we arrived at Hallium at 6 o'clock, we are the only ones at the ferry dock waiting to cross the Hjustafjord. We have waited until the night began before we left the cabin in the mountain valley high above the fjord. We prefer to drive in the dark on the road which takes us back to Bergen. In the night, you can hear better. And what we will hear, as we always do when we travel the night, are the Bach cello suites. When the ferry comes, we will begin the long journey. After 5 hours and 4 ferries, we will be home. All the fjords are connected. We will travel beside them and over them and around them. We will tunnel through granite and climb over plateaus. And just when we think we are deep inland, far from water, another fjord will appear beside us or in front of us or below us. All the fjords are deep. Some, like Sonja Fjord, are 5,000 feet deep, bottomless with memory. I will wait until we pass Nesvik before I start the music. I will wait until we are accelerating up the long hill. I will wait until the lights of the houses along the fjord fade from view. I will wait until our headlights are the only lights in the night. I will wait until the open mouth of the first tunnel faces us down the narrow road. I will wait until that moment of entry to turn on the tape. I would like to wait until the fear fades to start the tape, but the fear will never fade. The fear of the sheer drop on my side of the road, the fear of the raw granite tunnels, unlit and narrow, the fear of hitting a sheep on the road, the fear of skidding on ice, on being caught in an avalanche, the fear of encountering a speeding car on a stretch of one-lane road, the fear of swerving off the edge of the endless cliffs, the fear of a message which may come between our departure and our arrival. The fear is here always, a third traveler with us in the night. But if we travel in the dark, surrounded by song and by story, the fear will stay away. Tonight, after we pass through the first tunnel, after the tape has begun, the first of the six Bach cello suites, I watch the face of the man sitting beside me, a face careful in concentration of the road and of the map the music is making. Soon I will ask him, as I always do on this journey, to tell me again how his father's life and his own was saved by the Bach cello suite in C minor. How it was the fourth year into the German occupation of Norway, how rationing was short, and how those in the underground worked against more and more dangerous odds to bring food to those who had none. Four Norwegians arbitrarily chosen were shot in Trondheim. One of them was the actor starring in Ibsen's Wild Duck. He died in the street before his last curtain call came. One Sunday in October in 1944, the father said he was going to bring his cello to Hans Haugen out on the island. He invited the boy, only five, to accompany him. The mother objected. She said, "No, no, don't take the boy with you," over and over. But the father said to the boy, "Come with me," and he did. The father picked up the large wooden case that covered the century-old cello. But he took the cello out of the case and left the cello standing on its one leg beside the door, its dark wood polished and worn with years and perhaps with the burden of carrying the sorrow of song. The boy had heard the father play the cello many times. On Christmas Eve, when candles lit the tree, the father played, "Thy little ones, dear Lord, are we," and everyone sang all the verses, and sometimes they sang them all over again while the candles flickered on the tree. His father played the cello at every funeral at the church and always practiced late into the night before the day of a funeral. "O happy day when we shall stand," and "I know of a sleep in Jesus' name." When they took the bus to the valley to celebrate St. Hans Night, his father always carried the cello on his back high onto the plateau where the farmers gathered at the seders and sang by the fire until the early light of dawn, singing and sometimes dancing to the fireworks his father played on the strings of the fat, cumbersome shape. In the days before the war, his father had played in the orchestra, but the orchestra had stopped performing soon after the war began its performance in Norway. The boy thought there was nothing so safe as the time when his father sat down with his cello, with his eyes closed and his head vibrating, to notes that his right arm shoved into sound. The boy always conducted when his father played, The father never saw the boy conducting, and the boy would have been shy if he had. When he was alone, the boy sometimes ran his hand over the wood of the cello, wondering whether the pictures he saw when his father played came from the wood or the strings or something else, something mysterious, hiding inside the belly of the cello. His father said the boy could begin lessons on the cello when the war finished. "If the war finishes," his mother would whisper fiercely, and told him the best way to learn to play was to learn to listen. His mother always stopped what she was doing when his father played. It was the only time the boy ever saw her sit down without knitting or crocheting or mending in her hands or without the Bible to read. She would look at his father the whole time, and the boy knew she was looking at him even on the nights when the father played in the dark, those sad, long nights when the blackout meant either you went to bed, or if you were lucky, like he was, you listened to your father play music to cry to or dance to, but never to march to. The boy had seen the soldiers marching in the street. He couldn't remember a time when there hadn't been soldiers in the streets of Stavanger. He hoped he would never have to march with a line of unsmiling men. Never have to march as if you were being conducted by a hammer. The boy knew that if he were ever made to march, he was going to leave for the mountains, mountains where he knew there were hundreds of people hiding already in places too remote and too far for the Germans to find. Places where there were radios hidden, places his father knew of but never spoke about, not even to his mother. The day the father took him to the country, his father took the case of the cello to his car. His father drove to the butcher shop, even though the boy knew that his father knew it was always closed on Saturday afternoon. The father said, "Wait here for me," which didn't surprise the boy, and took the cello case with him, which did. When his father came back, he set the cello case in the back seat of the car, and all the way along the coast road, the boy could smell smoked meat mingling with the salt smell of the sea. They crossed the bridge and drove in silence to the end of the island. The boy watched the sea beating the rocks on the side of the road, and the boy wondered. The father stopped at a small red house. "Wait here for me," he said. "Honk the horn if you see anyone come. Anyone, do you hear?" And the boy knew his father meant, "If you see any soldier come." The boy knew, and he was afraid. Within minutes, the father came back, still carrying the cello case. "No one was home," the father said. "I tried to bring Hans the cello to play at the prayer house tomorrow, but no one was home. No one, do you hear?" And the boy knew it was a lie. He had seen someone drawing the curtain just when his father went round to the back of the house. He had seen the cello left at home, standing on its one leg by the door. On the way home, the father said, jovially, "Now we'll fish for the rest of the afternoon. You'd like that, wouldn't you?" And the boy knew that his father had been afraid, too. When they got home, the boy asked his father if he could carry the cello case into the house, but his father said no. His father went ahead of him, and the boy followed. His father carried the cello case with both hands as if it were filled with stone and weighing him down to the ground. And then his father stopped, blocking the doorway. The boy saw the legs of a uniform and pushed to get past his father. His mother was standing with her hand over her mouth, and the soldier's back was to the door. "He wants to know where you've been," the boy heard his mother say. "I brought the cello to Hans Haugen to play at the prayer house tomorrow for the Day of All Saints," his father said. "But I forgot that last night I played the cello myself and didn't put it back in the case." The boy was frightened. His father had spoken calmly, but there was a strange sound in his voice. The soldier pointed at the case. He spoke in German, loudly, a hammering sound. Swiftly, the father set the case down, picked up the cello, and was already drawing the string over the both. I don't quite understand what you are saying, but of course I'll play for you if that's what you want. And he dug the bow into the first note of the suite in C minor. He did not close his eyes as he usually did. He did not drop his head as he nearly always did. He sat on the hard wooden chair by the door and looked straight into the face of the soldier. And he played, and he played, and he played. And the boy watched the soldier, and the mother watched the father. Minutes went by, and the soldier didn't move, not a muscle in his face, not a bone in his body. When the piece was over, the German soldier, in his uniform and polished boots, was weeping. The father began again. And as the first note was struck and held and held and held until the boy thought his father's arm would fail, the soldier left, leaving the door wide open behind him. The mother dropped on her knees beside the father's chair, and the boy ran to her lap. And I have never tired of hearing the boy, the man sitting next to me, tell how his father slipped from the suite in C minor into playing a hymn, and how his mother and his father began to sing together and in harmony. Now the day is over, night is drawing nigh. Shadows of the evening steal across the sky. Father, give the weary calm and sweet repose. And then, the man has told me more than once, his father began to shake and could not continue playing. And the boy sat and wondered, would the soldier come back with more soldiers? Would they force open the case and see what had made it so heavy? The man is holding my hand. We are on a rare stretch of wide road, safe between the two sides of gentle mountains, surrounded by the lights of half a dozen homes in which nestle along this stretch of the road. For the moment, there is a light in the night, and safety and calm. For a moment, the fear is foreign to us, not present in memory or in time. And then we are climbing again, ascending another ribbon of road, rising like the surge of a Ferris wheel after pausing at ground level. When the dark mouth of the next tunnel is seen, the man puts both hands on the wheel. The tunnel is 4 kilometers long. The walls are rough and jagged. They have been blasted by dynamite, and they drip with water. There is no line on the middle or the side of the road. No light above or beside the road. No fan, no emergency phone, no sign, no turning place. No red light in front of us or white light coming toward us. We are alone, the two of us, in a blue Volvo, in a black hole, high on the side of a mountain, standing outside of memory and long before time. We are alone in hearing of the rich dark strings, sounding memory and mourning and hope. So what do you think about that one?
How many times did that hammer image? I saw the hammer when they were not like directing marching with the hammer, and then later hammering. Did it come to earlier? Did she use it more than just twice?
There's the hammer, that is the conductors, and the hammering sound. He spoke in German loudly. A hammering sound.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there might be a third one. Is there? No, I think just the two.
Do you know how she writes? Have you talked to her about how she does these things?
I know that the landing came out all in an hour.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. On the 5th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
But the suite in C minor, she's worked on over time.
Uh-huh.
She uses repetition beautifully. Mm-hmm. I will not start the music. And she doesn't just say before X, before Y, before Z. She says, I will not. Mm-hmm. I will not.
What's the effect of that?
A little bit ominous. But well, she was leading up to here. But it works.
And then the parallels at the end in the last paragraph that you read, I think that can't remember exactly what the images were, but they're stacked images, kind of.
The light.
She's dealing with this black hole. I mean, she comes to the black hole part at the very end, but she's got this stacking of images that is overwhelming, really.
I just realized that. I mean, practically, what she's trying to do is make a certain piece of music happen at that certain time.
Oh, really?
Or at least, I mean...
You mean for the reader? Are you talking about that?
Well, I mean, just in the narrative itself, it's very important to start the music at a certain point, and she starts it as they go into one tunnel.
But if
indeed the premise is true, that means that the music plays in a certain sequence. And it orders the...
Also, the music is protection. I mean, I see it as protection from the danger, as the cello playing protected the family.
Yeah, that last paragraph has the gentle mount, two gentle mountains and the wide road and the lights and some safety and calm. For a moment, the fear is foreign to us, not present in memory or in time. And then we are climbing again, ascending another ribbon of road, rising like the surge of a Ferris wheel after pausing at ground level. When the dark mouth of the next tunnel is seen, the man puts both hands on the wheel. The tunnel is 4 kilometers long, the walls are rough and jagged, they have been blasted by dynamite and they drip with water. There is no line in the middle of the side of the road. No light above or beside the road, no fan, no emergency phone, no sign, no turning place, no red light in front of us or white light coming toward us. We are alone, the two of us, in a blue Volvo, in a black hole, high on the side of a mountain, standing outside of memory and long before time. We are alone in hearing of the rich, dark strings, sounding memory and mourning and hope. The mourning is mourning. Mm-hmm. So the layering effect of, I mean, I find the end of that emotional. Did you? It really, and I think that having read The Landing adds to the to this piece. Mm-hmm. And that's what I said in the beginning about the importance of our hearing each other's stories and knowing the meaning of them and finding the layers of deeper and deeper meaning in when we tell each other our stories. I mean, I think it's a device to use in a congregation to make each other connect deeply and hear each other and honor each other's stories. I mean, in this story, something scary happened, but nothing terrible happened. Uh-huh. Yeah. But I find it very emotive and powerful.
I was confused or frightened by doing the driving at night. I mean, I know the explanation is for the sound. But I can't imagine doing that driving at night. And so I'm wondering if there's a metaphorical part of that in, maybe it's because of knowing about the landing and knowing what happened later, that the fact of life is that some of the driving is at night, not without the music, but that some of it's...
But you've got to drive through the night. The night is as much a part of life as the day.
Now, this was written after the second death, even though it's not mentioned.
February 1995, no, before.
Oh, okay.
So that's very poignant when you have told us that, too, to know that, first of all, she knows danger, and she knows life is dangerous because she lost her husband, but she's right again, life is dangerous because there is danger.
She senses maybe even some nervousness or danger about the relationship, but they're driving through the dark hole together in the midst of everything they've experienced in the past. And what? Who knows what they'll experience on the other end of the tunnel? I sense some relationals, even just between the two of them,
And that's heightened by her calling him the man.
Yeah.
In relation to the boy, the man. I mean, there's this kind of, there's some integrity in the other narrative, but it's not Carl, and it's not Carl's father, and so she's not part of the family.
She's an outsider looking into that family, and she wants to keep hearing that story again. And that's her way of trying to figure out who this person is next to her, as they're working through, their relationship.
Mm-hmm. What's kind of remarkable about it, too, when you put these two stories together, is that the husband gets killed in this absurd accident by a Mercedes, and the family is saved through this artistic performance, but saved from the Nazis. I mean, it's just interesting kind of...
How does Carl die? Or when does he die?
It'll be a year... soon, in the fall.
What happened to him?
He had a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you learn an apprehension about life that you don't have when you've gone through a shocking thing.
Yes.
And I think that reflected in the way she talks.
Yeah. Right, but now, I mean, and that, then in the last paragraph they go through the light, the valley, the whole, easier terrain, and then they go back into harder terrain again. But is it a hopeless story? Is it a negative story?
Because they keep doing it through the smooth terrain and the rough terrain. They keep moving forward. They have a destination that, and their hope and goal is to get home.
And they have the music.
And they have the music.
And they have the mountains. In the mountains here, high on the side of a mountain, standing outside of memory and long before time. But somehow the mountains are a witness to them. Mm-hmm. And it's a rich, dark string sounding memory and mourning and hope. Somehow I have the sense that there is a deeply rooted, grounded, that the mountains are not the enemy, that they're...
It's the way to get home.
It's the way to get home.
But do you have a sense? I have a sense that she feels different about this journey, or going through the Norwegian mountains than he may. That he may have a far more comfortable feeling.
She's Norwegian. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's his home. That's his home territory. I mean, I've had the same feeling over there. My gosh, I'm going to die on these.
Yeah, roads. Right.
But that maybe he has a steadier feeling than she does about it.
And I wonder if she's also, you sort of indicated that, you did, when you've been through a great tragedy, even though you have received hope again, there's always a little twinkling in the back that you never can rest, because it happened before and it could happen again. And she, in a sense, is saying, it could happen again, but I'll be ready this time. It's not going to be.
Life is going to go on.
Yeah.
There is night, but there is day. Day follows night.
She won't stay as long or avoid the landing the second time as long as she did the first time, if you want to compare the two stories or connect the two stories.
Now, I don't know if it's fair to. I mean, I think the second story is a really interesting story in itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the images that I loved, and I can't repeat it as she wrote it, but that the orchestra's performance ended and the war's performance started. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you read that passage again?
Yeah.
I thought that was just, I mean, when you think of an orchestra's performance, how marvelous that is. And then to imagine a war's performance, I've never thought of it in terms of
that. Where is that? In the days before the war, his father had played in the orchestra, but the orchestra had stopped performing soon after the war began its performance in Norway. Mm-hmm. The boy thought there was nothing so safe as the time when his father sat down with his cello with his eyes closed and his head vibrating to notes that his right arm shoved into sound.
That's wonderful.
Uh-huh. The security.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if the piece of music is the landing here. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. the safety, and the whole thing kind of moves around. And also what's intriguing is that they're cutting through the night. So there's no space that is stable in the second story. But this music kind of gives the center to the...
Mm-hmm. In the second story, when you're reading it, it's a very rhythmic read. As a reader, I can tell you that it drives on. It doesn't stop. It's got a beat. There's something about reading it that is interesting. What do you think about the German crying?
Bach. I mean, that was interesting. What piece of music was it?
It was a German piece. Yeah. And they were riding in a Volvo. Mm-hmm. No, that's Swedish, isn't it?
That's Swedish. It's not
German. What is that whole home thing again? Going home, because he was away from home.
What would it have meant if this story had not had any acknowledgement of the humanity of German soldiers? I mean, that would, for me, have been a real problem. Uh-huh. The hope, I mean, I guess we should ask about the role of religion in here, too, but somehow I felt very redeemed when the German soldier had humanity. Uh-huh. And I like the kind of symbolism. I haven't thought it through, but I like the feel of him walking out and leaving the door open.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was because it was Bach, though. I think it was because he was standing there and he had so much power over this family. That's why he was crying.
Who had so much power? The German soldier?
Yeah.
And that's why he was crying?
Yeah.
He was a kid. He was a kid, and the family was terrified, and he was moved by the music. And
moved by the father's courage. I mean, the staring at him.
Oh, yeah.
And what he was saying was not, it wasn't the father playing beautiful music and the German soldiers moved by it. It's the father's incredible courage to say, there's more going on here. Don't you dare just do what you're going to do. And then he plays this thing and it goes on for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. He's got every note down and he's staring at this German soldier. And it's a power move. It's not an artistic move, but it's remarkable that he does it with his music. It wouldn't have worked with anything else. It wouldn't have worked to talk. It wouldn't have worked. I mean, it's just this wonderful kind of mixing of things at that point. But it is about power and about shame, about fear.
I like that. Dan?
I was thinking if you go back to Gandhi and the movement in India, that this father was using some, he maybe didn't even know the principles of nonviolent resistance.
Yeah, yeah.
Which has tremendous power.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. you know, and the Norwegian people were doing this all over the place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably one example of how some people have said that Norwegians were driving the occupations out of their minds. They might have packed up and eventually gone home. By this kind of power that is not is not understood by people that only understand the power of weapons and rifles.
And there was this sort of rhythm of the hammer sound versus the Bach cello suites, you know, that they're two very different rhythms, and this man just committed himself to the beautiful. He stood there in a way that was not static but moving.
So he's a person and not evil himself, but caught up in an evil beyond himself. This kid, soldier.
Oh, I would think. That's how I think soldiers are.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of him and the driver of the Mercedes. If there are some connections there of a person caught up in something beyond himself.
Like addiction?
She doesn't do that with the driver of the Mercedes. He might be, but she doesn't do that.
But I see some similarities.
this last story reminded me, I teach high school English, and last year I had a class of juniors that I didn't quite know what to do with and was disturbed that they didn't know who Timothy McVeigh was. They hadn't been reading the news at all, so I decided to do a unit on what causes violence. And this poem don't list pieces that they just had to read, and then they workshopped, what does this piece tell us about what might cause violence? Anyway, as the workshop groups worked together, and for some reason I separated the women from the men and put the men in different in groups by themselves, and just the discussing of the violence made them more violent and louder. And I had to ask a male teacher to come down when they did their presentations because I was worried about the harassment. And then after it was all done, they did that part, and I thought, oh, we didn't deal with what's a solution to violence. And so I did the same kind of thing. I brought in poems. There's a poem. This is a poem to my son Peter, age 10, going on 11, which is asking for forgiveness. But then I read a story about in Germany where a man spent 50 years planting hundreds and hundreds of thousands of trees. Mm-hmm. And half of them died, but it changed the whole community. At the same time, I was playing Mozart in the back. Mm-hmm. And the students fell asleep. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, they said, oh, we are very sorry. We fell asleep while you were reading that story. I said, I asked the question, what is a solution? How do we solve the problem of violence? What happened in here today? You heard story, and you experienced music. And all of it was wiped away, and you slept, and you sat next to somebody you'd been arguing with the day before because of all of the images of violence that you had. Well, I hadn't really thought about that, but the way the music, my youngest daughter is here with me. She's just completing an internship in music therapy. And just before we came down, she was telling me some of the stories about, she said, you know, the physical therapists and the occupational therapists, they're all doing things, but I can do the same things they're doing and put music with it. And all of a sudden, their lives are, I mean, their whole person, it deals so, it hits so with the spirit in that sense that this is a fabulous story about how that works.
Well, I also wanted to, thank you. I wanted to say one more thing, which is that the importance of listening. And in that story, the mother listens. She sits with her hands not busy, and she listens to the dad playing music.
That was a great
one. Yeah. And who was listening to who when the soldier was playing? The soldier was listening, was looking at the man and listening. The mom was looking at the man. The boy was looking at the soldier. But there were a number of references to who listens to who and the power of that listening stuff. So I think that's important. I think it's time for us to end. But I really appreciate all of your comments. And
writing's available. I've heard her name, but I don't know if I've ever met her.
Where was the first one published?
In something called Other Voices, in the spring 1994 issue of Other Voices.
Is that a journal then?
It must be a journal, yeah. Volume 7, number 1, spring 1994. And this, I don't know, I think it's been published now, but I don't know where. When I got a copy of it, it hadn't been yet. And we hope her Lutheran merger book will get published, but it isn't yet. It's called Pillars of Salt, so if you ever see it anywhere.
Pillars what?
Pillars of Salt.
How is her last name spelled? How is that spelled?
S-C-A-R-F-E. S-C-A-R-F-E, scarf.
What's the middle? Is it a hyphenated?
No. Stoa is her middle name, S-T-O-A. It's her maiden name.
Her maiden name, though.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. You can tell you've done this more than once.
Yeah.